Hi, I'm Coach John Cook, and this is the Basketball and Life Podcast. Thanks for joining me for today's episode, where my guest is Cody Hartzler. Cody is the assistant women's basketball coach at Baldwin-Wallace University near Cleveland, Ohio, a Division III school in the Ohio Athletic Conference. Cody began his coaching career as a graduate assistant at Bluffton University under legendary head coach Guy Neal, and also had a stint at Washington and Jefferson as a basketball assistant coach. He's beginning his ninth season now with the Yellow Jacket Lady program. Please enjoy my visit today with Cody Hartzler of Baldwin-Wallace. Coach Hartzler, it's been a long time. I know we talk frequently in short snippets through social media or things like that, but I haven't talked to you in a long time. I want to tell you how much I appreciate you being willing to do the podcast with me, and just how's it going, man?
Well, Coach Cook, it's always good chatting up with you. We've got a longer history than I'd like to admit now. So the years keep on going by, and you've always been a good friend, so I was excited to be able to connect with you again today.
Well, I appreciate it, and it does feel like a lot of basketball journeys have some sort of connection through Bluffton University, Defiance College, Ohio Wesleyan University. It feels like there's a cradle of coaches there, and of course you spent time at Bluffton. We're going to get to that momentarily, but you're right. It's been a long time. It feels like it shouldn't be that long, but it has been, and I appreciate your willingness in the middle of, by the time this airs, it's going to be closer to the start of the basketball season, but for you right now, school's just kind of taken off again. Kids are back on campus, and you're in that kind of sweet spot of the academic and basketball calendar, but the real grind is just ahead of you, so I won't keep you long, but I do want to tell your story. So for anybody who doesn't know you, talk a little bit about where Cody Hartzler grew up and what your high school and college experience was like, and how you ultimately ended up kind of thinking coaching was for you.
Sure. Well, I'm born and bred in central Pennsylvania, and, in preparation for our call, I was thinking back to my journey in athletics, and I realized how fortunate I was to grow up where I did and when I did. At the risk of sounding like the old guy who's telling kids to stay off his lawn, it was just different back growing up in rural central Pennsylvania in the early to mid-90s where, youth sports, it wasn't about exposure, it wasn't about getting your name out there as much as it was about just learning the game and the coaches that I was exposed to. They weren't in it to make any career advancements. A lot of them were volunteers that just taught us how to play the game and let us be kids and enjoy it. So I fell in love with all things athletics at an early age, played multiple sports growing up, but I always had an affinity for the game of basketball, probably from watching my dad grow up playing and at the local community hall. And I had older siblings who were always involved, and I was that kid that would be out there at half times and timeouts, getting up as many shots as I could, because that was my safe place. And so if my love for basketball was kind of kindled at a youth sports stage, it was the furnace was flamed when I got into the junior high program. We were fortunate at our high school that we were under the direction of Coach Glenn Kyle. He was a part of, before he came to Indian Valley High School, which is where I graduated from, he was a part of Jim Boone's staff at Cal UP, where they were making runs in the NCAA tournament. He came to Mifflin County area with our coach, and just brought with him a wealth of knowledge about how to run a program and how to teach. If you don't know Jim Boone, he's like a motion guy, pack line. So that's how our program was run from seventh grade on. We weren't necessarily taught plays. We were taught how to play. And we were held to high standards. And then it was growing up, like, I wanted to play for Coach Kyle. I wanted to be Coach Kyle, man. I thought he was a high school gym teacher. He was like my idol when it comes to coaching. I wanted to be just like him, and that's really when I became more serious and fell in love with the details and just the overall different layers of the game.
Well,
so that's kind of where I got my start.
You said something there that jumped out at me when you talked about your youth sports experience. I wanted to make sure you played youth sports in the United States of America.
That's true. Isn't that something? Yeah. And it was like, you know, in the fall, you're playing soccer, football, and then basketball in the winter, and then baseball, everything you could get your hands on, man. And I was exposed to lots of coaches. And again, yeah, it was fundamentals and fun. And as you're alluding to, I think we've kind of gotten away from that a little bit.
I don't think there's any doubt that we have. And a lot of that has to do with a lot of things culturally about being a microwave society and not a crockpot society. A lot of it has to do with the fact that just, again, culturally speaking, the role of parents in the lives of their children is far different now than it was when you were growing up, and certainly different than it was when I was growing up. And that is not to say one is better or worse, but I would say undeniably that the culture that we live in today has negatively impacted youth sports in a lot of ways. I think that's almost undeniable. But you described something that I think is fairly common, Cody, in that guys grow up, ladies grow up playing sports at their high school where, you know, it doesn't feel as much that way now. Maybe I'm dismissing it, but the high school coach is a hero. It is more of a myth almost than a real person to people. And so when you fall in love with that version of what coaching is, and you have this love for sports that you have, when do you start remembering, or when do you remember trying to kind of assimilate or take on some of those coaching things and understand them and think about them as a real career avenue?
Well, I think it was, you know, so when we were coming up through, and I'd be participating in the youth camps that our high school program was running. A lot of it was I had great role models. They'd have the high school players come in, and they gave up their time to help us with their game. And like when I was in that position, then to kind of be a camp counselor of sorts, and you know, I it was a way for me. I don't know if I recognized it as a 16 or 17 year old that I was giving back to the game, but just the way that the kids looked up to me and like they responded to our coaching and just the enthusiasm that they brought to it. It was like, that's kind of when the bug probably started, you know. It's like, man, this is pretty cool being out in front of these kids and giving back and pouring into them. And that's probably when it started. To kind of move forward in my journey, like, I love basketball. I was a multi-sport kid, though, and like, I went out for track and field as a junior in high school, and I just picked up the high jump naturally. I ended up being like all state. I get way more attention recruiting being a track and field athlete than a basketball player. And like at that stage, so I'm getting recruited to play a track and field. I'm not factoring in. At that stage of my life, I wanted to be high school gym teacher, wanted to coach high school basketball. That was Coach Kyle was kind of my mentor, he's my idol, that's who I wanted to be. But here I am, a 17, 18-year-old kid making my college decision. I go to a school, Kutztown University, that doesn't even have physical education. You know what I mean? I was making my decision purely on who's giving me the most attention, what's the campus like, how do I connect? I probably didn't even look at the majors that they had. So I get to campus and I'm sitting there thinking like, okay, well, if high school teacher, high school coach is in the equation, what's the next best thing? And that's when I kind of started assimilating towards being a college coach. I was fortunate that one of the players from our high school that graduated 4 years ahead of me was in the college coaching ranks at the time, and he's a guy that I'd always looked up to. So I worked his camps in the summer, and he became a really big role model and springboard for me as well. So that's kind of how it progressed.
Well, and then you just saying that, you know, you started your journey by working the camp scene. That is also far less common now than it once upon a time was, because camps don't exist in the same format that they once did. So when you are a student at Kutztown State and you know, starting to work that journey, what was your college experience like as a student? You were I'm assuming a track and field athlete in college. And how did you keep tabs on or keep a vested interest in this coaching thing?
So I picked up a sport management major. So in all the classes that we would have, there's like a coaching minor, coaching element to the curriculum. And every project that I was doing, I was putting myself in the shoes of a college basketball coach. So that was part of it. That was part of my educational experience was, you know, the principles of coaching, the teaching elements to it. I was always envisioning myself as a college coach. And then, yeah, in the off season, I was working camps. During summer, I'd work for Coach Yetter, which is Unlimited Hoops LLC back in our hometown, and just staying plugged in the best I could during the summers.
And at that time, when you were going through that process, I think the word networking now is such a buzzword and has been for probably 35 years or so. Did you view it, what you were doing then, as networking, as building a network and a pathway to a career? Or was it more, I just get to be around the game and keep myself plugged in?
Yeah, I think it was more at that stage I was passionate about it. I loved the game of basketball. I knew if I was going, so part of it was, yeah, it was probably both. You know, I wanted to stay involved in the game. I knew that if I was going to get into the profession, like the camp scene was a great way for me to work on my voice and to stay connected. And what essentially it turned into was, it was kind of a job audition, you know, like when I graduated from Kutztown, then I got offered a part, to be a part of Coach Yetter's staff when he was at Pitt Greensburg. So it did end up being a networking, but that certainly wasn't the only angle that I had.
Coach, you just said something that really resonated with me, and I think it would be valuable for young coaches to kind of meditate on that notion of finding ways to develop your voice. As a coach, I think that's so underrated for young coaches because the game is so X and O driven now, and there's so many resources available to us from an X and O perspective that we can just get almost flooded with it and almost overwhelmed with it. But there is unbelievable value for young coaches to find opportunities to develop their voice in coaching, whether it's the camp scene or maybe coaching some AAU with younger players. And boy, that struck a chord with me because I think it's undersold and underappreciated what it truly means to develop your voice as a coach.
Yeah, you know, you go into a camp setting or a practice setting with all of these great ideas, whether you saw it online or you had your own experience and you want to pass and impart this wisdom, and you've got this scripted out in your mind, but it doesn't matter how articulate it sounds to you. If you can't express it and you can't get it across to your audience, then it doesn't matter. So that and a camp scene is a perfect way to kind of experiment with what works. And what makes it cool, too, is I think doing it at a youth level, I think a lot of people want to, when they're working with athletes, whether it's skill or the camp scene, they want to be working with like the prime time athlete. Well, it's easy to coach skills to someone who's already advanced or has been, like, you can really figure out how good of a teacher and how good of a communicator you are if you can get a group of third graders to jump stop layups and kind of command that huddle. So I think it translates, sure.
Oh, God, Cody, I hope there are so many former Bluffton Beavers out there who just heard the jump stop layups reference. I hope they tune in, man.
That drill will be passed down for generations.
No question. Well, let's fast forward just a little bit. So you're wrapping up your college career as a student athlete, looking toward career opportunities. You mentioned the camp scene being one avenue, but having other angles that you could pursue. What was your approach, and what opportunities did you have in looking for that first job after college?
Well, what you've got to keep in mind is the era in which I graduated. So I graduated college as an undergrad in 2009, at the height of the recession, and I'm talking like full-blown recession, where it was a complicated time to get into higher education, period, let alone college athletics. Everything was put on freeze. So some of the avenues and opportunities that I had, I had an opportunity to stay on Cookstown's track and field staff. That was presented to me. It was actually probably more compensated than what I ended up going, but I knew in my heart of hearts that I wanted to get back into the game of basketball, and so I passed that one down maybe foolishly. And really the only opportunity that I had that was set in stone was an opportunity to be a part-time coach on Coach Yetter's staff at the University of Pittsburgh at Greensburg. And at the time, Coach was a single guy. He had a spot in his house that he was going to let me live in rent-free. I picked up some part-time work to make ends meet because I was making maybe $2,000, and that was essentially the only thing. So I ended up moving out to Greensburg, packing everything to a car, living in one of his spare rooms, working at PetSmart in the morning, and then getting into the office at 9 o'clock. And Koji was like, I felt like I could have been working at Duke, man. It was we were working in the AMCC, Division III, whatever. But like it was a big time for me, man. And I was over the moon to have that type of opportunity as a 22-year-old.
Well, and I'm glad to hear you say it, because again, I just think where we are now, it's this lack of understanding that opportunity exists everywhere, and it oftentimes is disguised as really hard work. That's the bottom line with what opportunity is. And so when you describe working at PetSmart in the morning, getting to the office, and then kind of chasing your dream, that's a great story, but it's not a story. It's a lesson, and I hope some young coaches particularly will enjoy that and learn from it. I hope older coaches can reflect on it, because that's not a very typical journey now. So Pitt Greensburg is certainly a respected Division III program. Can you talk a little bit about your experience there, in particular, maybe some instances or events or occurrences that really were impactful on you as you started that part of your journey?
He just did a great job with his program organization. When it came to, leadership development, strength and conditioning, academic programming, again, we were operating as though, and he had experience. He was a Division II assistant, played Division II. Everywhere he had been, he had success, and that's just how we were operating. And it was I probably took it for granted at the time, but just the overall way he structured the program, and then the ability that, or the chance he took on me as a 22-year-old, I was a college track and field guy, I didn't play college basketball, and here I am a year older than some of these guys, but I was working. He gave me the perimeter position group. He let me take the strength and conditioning program and run with it. He trusted me to oversee their academic progress reports and whatnot. So he empowered me to take off everything that I could handle. And I just got my feet and fingers involved with every aspect of running a championship level program. And like when you're starting out, you don't even know what you don't know. So to have my eyes open to what went into running a college basketball program, it was like I couldn't get enough of it. So that was probably my biggest takeaway.
Cody, there's a marked difference between high school and college basketball on a lot of fronts, but one of the things that I think is consistent in both areas of coaching is that oftentimes I don't worry about young coaches and their knowledge of the game, their X's and O's and those kind of things. I just don't tend to worry, because as I said, there are so many resources available, and it's so easy to pursue those things. But I always kind of wonder about young coaches and their ability to handle what they view as the ancillary parts of coaching and what I view as the foundational parts of coaching. When you talk about academic organization, leadership development, the three things that you mentioned without talking about the actual basketball, those are the things that you don't you have to hunt those things down. They're not going to be readily and naturally available. And that goes for high school coaches as well. A lot of young high school coaches start into programs, and I'm always wondering, how are they going to communicate with parents? How are they going to handle the organizational piece? And so when you acquire that, first of all, the knowledge that you acquire is important, but when you discover that you're actually passionate about it, that you're hungry for it, it's got to start you thinking about college coaching in a very different way maybe than you just were 2 or 3 years before.
More touch points to serve and mentor our players. And I think that's really, I've got a heart for servantship. I believe in it into my core. And it's just the more opportunities that you have to serve, it was just incredibly fulfilling. And I probably didn't realize it at the time, but it was an excellent opportunity for me to earn the respect of our team as well, because they knew I cared about them more than just what they could do on the basketball floor. Like, when you're pouring into somebody's social life and you're helping them develop as a human being and you're holding them accountable in the classroom, it forms an unconditional type of trusting relationship. So then when you are on the floor, if you make a mistake, when you make a mistake, there's grace in it because they know you care. And but without those different touch points, I think it's harder to develop those types of relationships.
Well, I say it all the time on the podcast that no matter who I interview or what we talk about, there's going to be one thing that I wish I could kind of bottle and give away or maybe set aside as a separate recorded part. I think you just gave some people a real, real good value for this podcast. So I hope we didn't completely shoot our wad in the first 21 minutes, but there's real value in what you just said, and it was exceptional. I want to, before we have to take our break here in about 8 or so minutes, I want to give you a chance to talk about the next step in your career. You spent and remind me the time that you spent at Greensburg, but outside of the fact that you were working at PetSmart and making $3,000, what else would have made you want to find something else to do?
Well, you know, when I graduated college, I had a 5-year goal of becoming a full-time head coach or a full-time assistant coach. I had a 10-year goal of becoming a full-time head coach. So in my mind, in that first 5 years, it was going to be imperative for me, in order to land the full-time assistant job. At the time, it was like, okay, you might have to volunteer, then you might have to be part-time, then you might have to do a GA, and then you can think about becoming eligible, especially as a non-college basketball player. That might be my journey. So going into my second year, at Pitt Greensburg, we were actually under new leadership. Sean Strickland came in. He was actually the women's assistant at Boulder Wallace prior to taking on the head men's basketball coach at Pitt Greensburg. So I got to work with him for a year. And during that second year, we went to Bluffton University's holiday tournament and played 2 games out there. And at the time, when we went out there, I knew I had some preliminary conversations with Coach Neal with scheduling. I knew he had a GA position that was going to be coming available the next year. So I made it a point to stay in touch with Coach Neal after we had got done playing that year. And then that following spring, after my second year at Pitt Greensburg, I got to get involved in the process to become Coach Neal's graduate assistant. And that was kind of what springboarded me into the next stop.
So, I have a really good understanding of Coach Neal's program. Obviously, you know that. You and I crossed paths at that time. But when you talked about what was so impactful to you in your first season at Pitt Greensburg, I got to imagine arriving at Bluffton, there was a lot of similarity in terms of the things that were valued in the program. What did it do for you? Where did it further your vision of yourself as a coach? Or how did you grow during your time at Bluffton?
So I was that. It was like if I had an undergraduate degree in what it looked like to organize a college basketball program at Pitt Greensburg, I got a master's degree at Bluffton just with the time and the attention to detail that Coach Neal operated with was unmatched. But, you know, as the more I think back to it, that's really where I cut my teeth as a recruiter. I think there's a lot of things that made Coach Neal a legend and one of the best small college basketball coaches to ever do it. But I think maybe one of the things that gets undersold, I don't know, is his ability to recruit. I just remember we'd go in on a Sunday night. That was a big call night here. So he was big on being together as a staff as we were making our calls. And just hearing him communicate and navigating families through the recruiting process, it was invaluable for me to be sharing an office with him and just hearing him. It wasn't even, he was just being himself, you know what I mean? And he was very comfortable in his own skin. And when we get kids to campus, he was unbelievable on campus visits. And the biggest thing I took away was it was just authentic. He was who he was. He sold a vision and of where they were going to be. He told stories in a way that got people excited and wanted to be a part of. And, you know, there was a lot of organization that went into it. There was a lot of hard work and hours that went into the recruiting. But just overall, just how he approached making calls, connecting with high school coaches, the visit itself. I feel like who I am as a recruiter today stems a lot from my time with Coach Neal.
Well, I think that I'm glad to hear that because I think a lot of times people who have a familiarity with Coach Neal might understand the organizational part and may not know about the recruiting piece. And as you're adding to your portfolio, so to speak, as you're adding to your skill set, you're doing so with the intent of taking away all the good things, but also preparing yourself for the next step in your journey. We're kind of in that gray area where I probably ought to go ahead and take a break now. But when we do come back from the break, I kind of want to get into the combination of what you talked about developing your voice, about taking and keeping and culling these valuable things that you want to add to who you are, and how it starts to shape you as a coach. And then we'll talk about your jump to the women's side after that.
Sounds good, Coach.
All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Hi, this is Coach John Cook, and I wanted to take just a quick second and a short break from the podcast to say thank you so much to those of you who regularly listen to Basketball and Life. I appreciate your listenership and support more than you know, and I wanted to give you a heads up on some things that have changed here at the podcast. We now have our own page on X. It's B-Ball and Life Pod, at B-Ball and Life Pod, if you want to get information on the podcast, upcoming episodes, or possibly activate archived episodes or share information with us. Feel free to reach out at B-Ball and Life Pod if you want to get to us on X. I also want to let you know that we are developing a website for the podcast. That website will be up and running sometime in the very near future. And there you can see all archived episodes. You can get show notes. You can subscribe to a newsletter. There's the possibility of purchasing merchandise for the Basketball and Life podcast. And if you are a regular supporter of or would like to be a supporter of the podcast, we're going to be shifting our focus from using Spotify for podcasters to using our website to allow people to support the podcast. I just want to give you a heads up on that. And again, stay tuned because those changes will be coming very soon. Thanks again for listening to Basketball and Life. Now back to the podcast. All right, Cody. So the GA situation at Bluffton is well chronicled on this podcast. We've talked to a number of guys who have kind of gone through that process, and it's a 2-year commitment to Bluffton. You're getting your master's degree. You talked about your experience in working for Coach Neal. As you get through year two and you're working your way through, how do you balance all the work that it takes to be a GA when you're a part of a 2-man staff? That's all there is at Bluffton, essentially. And you're still trying to look at what's ahead and what opportunities exist for you. Talk to me about how that kind of evolved for you.
You know, it's interesting, Coach. In that I've never been good. I'm not a great networker. I've never been good at every time I feel like I've tried to make a plan, it never goes accordingly. So I've always just kind of lost myself and kind of trying to really focus on being where my feet are. And I loved working for Bluffton. I loved it. So I just got lost in it. And it just always worked out for me that when I'm just where I'm at, and I do my best, the opportunities present themselves. So after the spring, I graduate in the spring of 13, I think it was, and I didn't have anything cooking. We were trying to make some things work in Boston. Maybe I stay on in type of a part-time situation and continue. And I was on board with it. And then it gets to be about late July, early September, and an opening comes open on Washington and Jefferson College's men's staff. I got the opportunity to interview with Glenn Gutierrez, who he was a part of the Jim Boone coaching tree as well. He was Jeremy Etter, the guy I got started with. He had worked with Coach Gutierrez, and Coach Gutierrez worked for Jim Boone. They both worked for Jim Boone. Anyway, there was a connection there, and I go and interview, and like I leave campus with an offer, and like the next week I'm moving to Washington, Pennsylvania. Member of the President's Athletic Conference, learned a ton from Coach Gutierrez. He was another motion guy. He was incredible at breaking down film and teaching the game, pack line up and on the line, or pack line defense, just a master tactician. Really good, and I was back in Pennsylvania. At that time, I went from being a GA to being quote-unquote intern, where I'm making like $15,000. I got room and board. They gave me $200 to spend in the cafeteria. I thought I had made it. I could start saving up for like an engagement ring. I could make a car payment. Like I thought I was living large. But I still wasn't full time though. So I always had, again, that was like my 5-year goal. I wanted to be a full time assistant. So after my first year at WJ, I had an opportunity to interview at Baldwin Wallace for the men's basketball assistant under Coach Sheldon at the time. And I went through the process. It was in part because of Sean Strickland. He had some Baldwin Wallace ties. Coach Neal had some Baldwin Wallace ties. They kind of got me in the door. And I got on campus, went through the process, didn't end up getting the offer. But throughout the interviewing, Coach Sherry Hare was on the committee. And I don't know, we kind of hit it off. She was a part of the phone interview, and I got to meet her on campus. And went through that next year at WJ, and then Coach Hare had an opening on her staff. And to that point, I had never considered, being a women's coach. Or, like, it was never a variable for me. Not that I was opposed to it. It just hadn't crossed my mind. But I was incredibly impressed with Baldwin Wallace as a university. Maria was beautiful. It had a lot to offer. And then I was on the outside looking in. It was an opportunity to coach under a legend, be a part of a program that has legitimate championship aspirations. And the bottom line was, it was full time. I was just about to turn 26. I didn't have health insurance. I was engaged to be married. I needed to start thinking about, like, how can I make this career at least somewhat financially feasible? And it was an opportunity that at the time I felt like I couldn't pass up. So that's kind of what got me into the women's side here at Baldwin Law. So that was the fall. It was August of 2015. And I've been here ever since.
Cody, it is a monumental day in the life of every coaching junkie who's gone through the journey. It is a monumental day when you finally realize, wait, I got to do this and grow up? Like, what in the world is that about? So you use the word legend to describe Coach Herrer, and I always struggle with that word because to me, you know, true legends are they've got to move on from the game. And but there is no other word to describe certain people on your journey other than legendary. What they do is legendary. It is across the scope of not just their university, but Division III basketball. And Coach Harris certainly qualifies in that category. And so I know you've used the word blessed a lot. The fortune that you had of cutting your teeth and developing into the coach that you wanted to be under the people that you did was undeniable. But when you walk in the door at BW working for a coach of that stature, you've spoken about the fact that you've kind of worked toward developing your voice. You've learned a great, great deal about program organization. You really feel like your time at Bluffton it helped develop you as a recruiter. When you walk in the door to start that job day one with BW, what did you view as your best way to contribute, and how did things evolve in that initial year at Bolden Wallace?
Of trying to be well-rounded and having the skill set and just the work ethic to whatever's going to help the head coach's life be easier, like I'm ready to take that on. And at the time, I think the biggest two things that hit the ground running with Bolden Wallace was heading up our recruiting efforts and really trying to get some energy into that part of the program. Opponent preparation is something that I was able to take off the coach's plate, so the scouting reports, and I, all along the way, whether it be Pickeringsburg, W&J, Bluffton, I was heavily involved in apartment prep, so I was able to take that off. And then it was interesting, like, you know, coach is probably the most accomplished from the wins and, like, championships coach as I had worked for, and maybe it was a product because I was older, I had unbelievable, I felt really confident in my preparation, so I was confident in the wisdom that I had taken from all the stuff along the journey. I was just a better coach, and she empowered me, man. She gave me a huge voice when we were on the floor at practice and in games. Just as we kind of continued to evolve, she kind of we developed a relationship that, like, she knew who I was and what I stood for, and we aligned a lot in our vision on how the game should be played. It was just kind of like a seamless thing where she just kept on giving me more responsibility, and it just helped me grow and continue to be, like, the more she gave to me, the more passionate I got about the program, and the more steps that I took. So it was really, I feel like it was mutually beneficial. I was able to take a lot off her plate and allow her just to do what she's best at. And at the same time, it was just an unbelievable opportunity for me to grow and kind of get outside of my comfort zone.
Well, you know what's really interesting is you mentioned being empowered by your head coach, and I don't know. I'm not trying to tell anybody how to be successful as a head coach. Hell, I don't know that I ever had any real success as a head coach. But I think what you just mentioned is important because every head coach wants their assistants to buy in and take ownership of their role and their place in the program. And I really believe this, Cody, that if you want people to take ownership of something, you have to empower them. You can't just demand it from them. You have to empower them. And when you get that and you take ownership of it, I think for most guys and ladies in this profession, our work ethic will generally drive us to success if we know what we're supposed to own, if we know what's ours and we can take it and run with it. But as you go through that process, you mentioned something about the need and the importance of taking things off the head coach's plate. I have said for years that I think the number one responsibility of an assistant coach is make the head coach's life easier without completely destroying your own.
Yes. And that's the thing that, like, I don't want it don't get it twisted. Like, because I was easing the burden for coach, and I was taking on some things, that didn't stop her from, like, investing the same amount of time. It was just a really good balance, man. Like, I was getting it from it, she was getting from it, and it just worked. She's incredibly selfless when it comes to, like, you know, making sure I was getting home and taking care of my family. And she's never put anything on my plate that was gonna throw off my workload, like, that I wasn't signing up for to begin with. So she's just got an unbelievable feel when it comes to that.
And as you look back on that, you're closing in on a decade there at BW, not quite there, but you're closing in on it. I don't know how you would try to go about ranking an order of what you feel like you've gained, but can you touch on some of the things that maybe you feel like are specific lessons to Coach Herrer and being a part of her program?
Well, just the nature of my tenure here, the duration, like, every other stop, I had been there for 2 years. So the reward and satisfaction of recruiting a class of high school seniors and then being with them throughout their entire collegiate journey, seeing them walk across the stage, like, that has an element to it. You know what I mean? Like, I've been hooked on coaching since day one, but that was just something that I had not experienced. And that's a whole nother level of, that brought out a whole nother level of commitment and just a sense of responsibility where, like, man, we're setting these kids up for the future here, and, like, you actually get to see it. So now, you know, I'm being invited to weddings. I get to see people starting their lives as alumni that I got to work with for 4 years. I've had multiple recruiting classes come through, and there's, like, a sense of I try to avoid pride throwing that out there, but just maybe ownership of the program. That I wasn't able to develop when you're just bouncing around beginning with your career, and you don't get to see kind of the long-term results of the time you're investing with people.
I love that sentiment, Coach, because I really do think that the word that often gets lost, and you know, we are proud of kids that come through programs that we're a part of, but what really stood out to me after being able to spend multiple stops at a place, I was the same way, 2 or 3 years and move on. But I've been back through Bluffton a couple of times. I spent a couple of stints with the women's team at ONU. What really jumps out is you start to understand that it's actually a stewardship. Like, these are people's children, and there's a legacy to this program that I'm getting to steward this thing for the time that I have. And that to me is a real way to keep a good perspective on things. At least that's how I see it.
Well, I think that's what keeps me intrinsically motivated. That privilege really is what it is as a coach or an educator, however you want to phrase it. To have that type of impact on people, and that's a very powerful motivator. I learned a lot from that. The other piece of it that I'd be remiss to say, and, like, my takeaway of my time at BW is, like, we've won, brother. Like, nothing against the coaches that I worked for under whatever. It's just there's different expectations, and the design of our program isn't just to, like, you know, be the last team standing in the OAC. That's certainly part of it, but, like, we're designing everything we do about making a run in March, and I just hadn't had that type of experience before, and there's, like, good and bad that comes with that as well, but, boy, that's pretty fun. It's fun going on those types of runs, and getting to work with someone who's been there, done that multiple times has been a really good lesson for me.
I want to shift gears just for a second, because earlier in the podcast you mentioned working for a couple of guys, several guys actually, who at their core are pack line guys and motion guys. And so that's all part of your background. As you look to where you are now as a coach and where you've been, obviously Coach Herrer is going to set the tone for what the program is, and philosophically you guys are in step. You've said that. How has, I guess I should say, your version or view of X's and O's and the way you want to play the game. How has it evolved from when you first began to where you sit today?
I've always been a huge fan of the art of the game of basketball, where it's like, it doesn't matter, like the synergy that happens with players on the floor. And I think that starts on the defensive end. I think the best way to develop that type of cohesion is to have high standards on the defensive end, because it's unglamorous. Everyone is on the floor are bought into getting stops. It just has a way of helping control the locker room and the morale of the team. I'm a believer of that. I've always been that. That's the same. Where I've probably gotten more, what's kind of opened my eyes working with Coach Hare is Coach is a mathematician. Like she was a math teacher as an undergrad at Finley, got her master's degree in it, whatever. And she takes a very analytical approach to the game. So it's all about, like, you know, the efficiency numbers, points per possession, you know, if free throws, layups, and uncontested threes are the most efficient shots in the game, well, then you're designing your defense to take away those shots, and your offense should be generated or designed in a way to create those types of shots. And what I think has been cool is there's the science part of it. There is the art and the expression piece of basketball that I think has been a really cool way of blending it, because even if the analytics say that I'm going to use Emily Irwin, our all-conference point guard, if the analytics say that the most efficient way to score every time is to have Emily Irwin come off a high ball screen and shoot it every time, like, that doesn't work. In a game of basketball, it's never going to be cut down to strictly science, strictly numbers. There's like, you can't ask somebody to play defense all that. This isn't friggin' the James Harden Rockets we're talking about here. These pros are getting paid millions of dollars to stand in the corner on offense and be okay with it. Like, you've got to have some ball movement and some opportunities for people to make plays, regardless of what the efficiency says. So that's kind of my overall view on how the game is played. We do take an approach now of Walden Wallace where, as opposed to packing it in, we are a little bit more disruptive in passing lanes. We would get up and on the line just because, you know, we've got some really good coaches in our leagues that run some really good sets. And if we let them get to their spots, we feel like our biggest advantage is sometimes our depth and our athleticism. So it just leverages our strengths a little bit more to try and be a little bit more disruptive. And then that's kind of what fuels our transition game and whatnot.
Well, we could do a whole bunch of X's and O's, and I tell people this all the time. Like, there are lots of podcasts out there that are X and O based, and I thought maybe this one was going to be, but this one's much more about the stories. And so I kind of want to touch back on something you said. You mentioned earlier about coming out of college with kind of a 5-year goal and a 10-year goal. You know, the head coaching thing has been out there for you before as a goal. But you also describe your situation at Baldwin Wallace as one that is very good for you. How do you look at the possibility of being a head coach one day now compared to the way you saw it then? And what has maybe created that mindset that you have now?
I think the thing I've learned, the longer that I've been in higher education, is it's much less for me now of having the title of head coach as it is like where you're working and with whom you're working. So for me at this stage in my career, I've had some opportunities, schools reach out, I've gone through some processes where the school itself as an institution, either I wasn't aligned with their overall university mission statement, or there was some disconnect where within the people in the administration I just didn't align with, and I didn't feel comfortable going to work, or it was a situation where, you know, I'm not sure this place is going to be open. in 5 or 10 years. Like, that's the last. Or, you know, I go there and I invest all this time, and I'm not sure that you can get a turnaround, you know? And because most of the jobs that I've been involved with are rebuilding type of situation. I've taken the approach that I know I'm making an impact on people's lives. I know that I'm appreciated and I'm valued at Baldwin Wallace. We do have, you know, standards, and we're chasing something that not a lot of people have the opportunity to pursue realistically. And like that's, I have fulfillment. I'm not going to leave a place like that just for any job. Now, if the right situation would open itself up, it's not like I've turned a blind eye. Like, I keep my resume updated. But it would have to be a special situation. And then you factor in, like, you know, my wife's got a really good job in the greater Cleveland area. We like Berea. We've got roots. We love our church. We love the community. Like, it becomes bigger than just I'm not a young middle-aged 20-year-old whose only aspiration essentially was his career. There's more variables to it than just age.
As you lay out all of those factors that have impacted you now at this point, you touched on two things that I know are incredibly important to you: your family and your faith. I use the phrase "real parent" in air quotes. I say this to people who are close to me. You're a real parent now because you got two of them. And
we're the playing field is even. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess it's a cliche question for me at times because I ask it in almost every podcast. Talk about what things you do intentionally to maintain some level of balance between the all-consuming thing that is coaching plus your family and the importance of your faith, and how has coaching impacted your family, or vice versa? How has your family impacted you as a coach?
That's a great question, Coach. And here's what I'll say. I'll tie it into my faith first. Being a coach and being a husband and being a father has it's a humbling experience. It really makes it clear to me how imperative my spiritual walk is. You know, I can't do any of this without the love and protection that I get from my Lord and Savior. So I'm constantly reminded that if I try to do this on my own, or going back to the whole, like, walking my own path and not trying to stay aligned, keeping my focus on my God, then just things just get out of wire, and I'm constantly reminded of that. So being a parent, being a husband, being a coach, it's a constant reminder of how much I need divine intervention, essentially. And then I think what's helped is, and Coach Harris enabled this, is kind of blending it, you know, like, yes, there are points in time during the year where I can, when I'm at home, I don't have to think about the sport. I don't have to think about my career. But during the season, man, like, there has to be some integration there. Otherwise, you don't get to see him. So, you know, my wife is heavily involved in our program. She leads a Bible study. Our girls can call in mentors. So she's got relationships with the players in our program as well. As we speak, one of our players is watching our 2-year-old. So, like, there's some integration there. My kids are at practices, they're at games. So I don't know that you can, if there's a way to compartmentalize it, I haven't figured it out. There's got to be a blend to it. And then you just really got to take advantage of the opportunities in the schedule where you can unplug and just be completely invested in your family. To be honest with you, I do think I'm certainly pulling in more directions now as a father and a husband, but it's made me a better coach. I'm a better communicator. As you know, like, if you're not patient yet as a parent, like, you're gonna get to learn lessons on patience. And I feel like that's made me be able to serve the players in our program better. And then there's the sense of the whole stewardship that you brought up earlier that, like, yeah, I'm entrusting people's to children. And this just takes on a different meaning when you've got kids of your own. And it's something that I don't take lightly. So in a lot of ways, as challenging as it's been, I think it's made me a better husband, a better father, hopefully, and a better coach.
Well, Cody, the last part of the podcast now is something I call two whys and two whats. So it's four questions, two why questions and two what questions. And I'm going to throw them out there and let you answer them each kind of in succession. Take all the time that you need or as little as you need to answer the questions. They're pretty straightforward and direct, and maybe something that might feel like I'm putting you on the spot a little bit, but that makes it kind of fun for me. So humor me.
I think.
All right. So the first why question is why do you coach?
Of the plan for me, and I think that my Lord has gone before me, and it's kind of it's been a broken road at times to get me where I am today. But as I look back, the people that I've been put in place with, put in contact with, the lessons I've learned, I think it was all. It was all part of the plan all along, so I think this is my calling.
And so in response to that, then, there's the style with which you coach. So why do you coach the way that you coach?
I just believe that coaching at its core is caring for people. It's loving them, and that's a unique way for – I don't hide from my faith. I'm not an evangelist though either. It's not a part of every conversation I have, but it is an opportunity for me to love well the way that I think we're supposed to. And that's what I hope people feel when they're being coached by me or they're interacting with me, they're working with me. It's just someone that you know, they know I have their best interest in mind. I care about them unconditionally, and that's kind of why I coach the way I do.
So that's a good lead in, and maybe partially answers the third question, the first what question, two whys and two whats. The first what is, what is it like to be coached by you on a daily basis?
I've been talking about a lot of my soft skills. I think I'm empathetic. I feel like I make people feel heard and understood, but at the same time, I'm competitive, man. I'm a middle child. I got counted on my entire life. Nothing's ever really been handed to me, so I've had to earn everything. So I love winning, dude. I hate losing too, but I love winning. So I'm a competitive guy, but I hopefully. I'm trying not to lose sight of the bigger picture
either. So, and again, I think that's a nice lead into the final what question. What does success mean to you? Outstanding stuff, Cody. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I say this, it seems like, after almost every guest, and oftentimes I wait till we're not recording anymore, but it's humbling to me the relationships that this game has given me, And it's also heartbreaking to me that I don't have a way to maintain them a little more successfully. I hope we can cross paths and catch up again soon face to face, but just want to tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time to do this and chat with us and tell your story, man. It's been a blast.
You know, like I said at the beginning, every time I get the opportunity to talk to you, I come away feeling good. So it was an honor and a privilege to spend some time with you, Coach. Best of luck to you. You know, I'll be pulling for the Beavers, my friend.
I much appreciate it, brother. Thank you.
All right, Coach.
Hi, I'm Coach John Cook, and this is the Basketball and Life Podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in and checking this one out. If you're listening on Spotify, courtesy of our platform, Spotify for Podcasters, you have the opportunity to make a donation to the podcast. If you would be inclined to do so, there's a link at the bottom of the episode that will allow you to make your donation in whatever amount you would choose to do so. If you're listening on any other platform, I just ask that you please rate, review, and subscribe, and come back anytime to check out more episodes here on the Basketball and Life Podcast.